Today's program is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin is home to the nation's only Master Cheesemakers program that provides innovative cheesemakers with continuing education opportunities? To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
This week, it's the season finale of Meat and Three. We're following up our episode about youth with a look at age and how aging affects life on farms and in kitchens.
At the most basic level, we need people to grow food for a growing global population.
The question of planning for retirement or old age as a cook, it's almost one that doesn't exist bizarrely until it's too late.
We also have a story about a food that might be older than you think.
A recent archaeological finding might have CrossFitters everywhere reevaluating their diets.
Plus, a story about one of Atlanta's most historic and risque landmarks.
There are dancers that have been there 20 and 30 years.
Don't miss our season finale of Meat and Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Allie Kane. Welcome to In the Sauce, a new podcast about building food brands. We live in a culture that romanticizes entrepreneurship and the hustle, but what I really want to hear are the stories from the trek uphill. And I want advice, in real time. This is the story of Haven's Kitchen Sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand, because we're all in the sauce. Today I'm speaking with Kiki von Glinau, founder of Toast Media Group, a new company that helps brands with digital growth and social media, strategy, and management. After 6 years at HuffPost, leading programming, distribution, analytics, email marketing, and SEO groups, Kiki went out on her own and somewhat inadvertently, I think, became a highly sought-after consultant. Kiki's email newsletter is one of the only ones that I actually read. It is that good. So before anything else happens, how do people get your newsletter?
Oh my gosh, you're also putting me on. I actually need to start sending it regularly now.
Yes, you do.
They can go to my Instagram and from my link in bio, sign up from it there. My Instagram is just my name, Kiki von Glinau.
Yes, which is a real name.
It's a real name. It doesn't, you know, I'm sure everyone's like, and how do you spell that? But yeah, you'll find me.
You'll see it on when I post.
Perfect.
And it's funny because we met through Instagram.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have that many people that I meet through Instagram.
It's
but
2018.
I know. Yeah. It's really cool. And what's great is that I just thought you were like a really avid follower. And you just seemed groovy.
Yeah.
And then I reached out to you because as an avid follower, I kind of wanted to know how you would like to think about using our sauces. And then you told me about your experience and what you did for a living and everything. And I had no idea. So that was embarrassing and also fun at the same time. So back up a little bit because I think there's like a Margaret Mead quote, or maybe it's Bill Gates. It's one of them about how basically when you're raising kids, you don't know exactly what the careers are going to be when they're adults.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the same things that were kind of important, you know, 2,000 years ago, resilience, creativity, et cetera, are the actual same things that are important now. They just kind of manifest differently. So I think about that with someone like you, right? Because you didn't go to fifth grade and take social media, you know, for 10-year-olds. And there wasn't like English, math, bio, Instagram.
Yeah.
So how did you...
If only.
Right, exactly. There might be now. But how did you... What were you interested in as a kid?
Yeah.
And how has it sort of influenced you in your career? And how'd you get where you are?
Yeah. So I actually... Journalism is really what led me on this path. When I was in high school, I started working for my school newspaper and just kind of became obsessed with it. I knew that's what I wanted to do. And I think also when I was in high school, like there were a lot of movies about the magazine industry.
Yep.
So I think that's what I wanted to do.
So your goal was like editor of a magazine.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I was obsessed with Vanity Fair when I was younger.
Right.
So yeah, that was definitely the trajectory that I was headed for. And then I ended up going to NYU and it was also all about being in New York. So I was like, I know I need to be
Where
in New York.
Where did you grow up?
In Chicago.
Okay.
So I came to NYU majored in journalism and English and creative writing.
Okay.
When I was in school, digital wasn't really a thing yet. We were still, it was all very magazine and newspaper centric, which
And were you more, you were like, not, this is Kiki Von Glinna reporting from
the
Beat.
No, I was all written. Yeah. All, okay. Yeah, all text based.
All right. Although that would have been great for you. Like you would have actually been great at that.
I would not have been comfortable with that. I was still like coming into my own skin, I think, at that point.
But all right.
Yeah, they did have broadcast at that time when I was in school. But it was like for the text based side, it was all very much, we learned about like, it's crazy to think about. I think like the year after I graduated, they were like, oh, we live in a digital world. Like, let's change the journalism program a little bit. But from there I went on, after I graduated, I got an internship at HuffPost. So HuffPost was really my first and only kind of job. It stuck around there a long time, but I started there, as a journalist. That's kind of what kind of got me on this path of digital media and social media.
And what kind of journalism, like what were you writing about?
So in the very beginning, it was all entertainment based. I kind of came up at HuffPost through the entertainment side of things, which for us was like celebrity, movies, TV, culture, art, that kind of stuff.
Right.
And I remember when I first started working there, it was a very competitive environment because at that point, HuffPost was kind of winning the internet and one of the first really scaled digital publishers. So it was always like which author had the most amount of views on their stories. And I became super obsessed with always being at the top of that list.
Hence the analytics started becoming important.
Right. So I got very interested in how audiences found stories online, what that behavior was like. I remember at HuffPost, for HuffPost Entertainment, I remember the moment when we were like, we should probably create a Twitter for us. Like, I mean, it was still very, really, I mean, it wasn't that long ago, but social media was still very new, and we were very much at the age of being early to it as a digital publisher, so got to learn a lot about like the explosion and boom of social media when it came to just the digital space.
And then so as you took your sort of, I want to know how people are finding what they're reading and how did that turn into like digital media? You know, I mean, how did, what happened next?
Sure. Just by like kind of talking to other teams and journalists who are in general kind of a very delicate group of people about kind of really valuing not only the story, but also how people are finding it. I just kind of became a voice within the newsroom of someone who understood both sides. I wasn't someone just coming from like a marketing background or an analytics background who didn't get what it actually meant to create a story and tell a story. I had both pieces. So I just kind of Ariana was really hands-on at that point and kind of saw that I was someone who had both sides of my brain and kind of was just like, you're leading this now. You are now our head of growth and analytics. I mean, and that was also like over a span of like 6 years.
Right, but that's phenomenal.
Yeah. That's the cliff notes.
And then now, you know, the way that I've sort of told myself your story is that you left that, you had this other idea, but basically there were a lot of people like me who were like, wait, we need help. Can you help us? Can you help us?
Yeah.
And you started helping and then it became a consultancy. And then now you're basically turning away people.
Yeah.
And that's my movie version of
I
your
like
life.
That version.
Okay.
I originally left HuffPost to explore a different idea, which I'm still kind of noodling on and pushing forward. I started kind of talking with brands more specifically about how my experience could help fuel their business goals. And it kind of became an accidental consultancy where now I have quite a few people working on my team with me, some of whom you've met.
I saw an ad or an Instagram post that you need more people on your team. It's very cool. And so what do you do exactly?
One thing I like about being small and scrappy is that we kind of take our experience or our collective experience and really try to figure out something that's bespoke to the client that's coming to us. So a lot of people, or the majority of people, have really found us through referrals.
So you can use me as an example because I feel like
sure
it's
Yeah.
Havens is, this is about it.
Yeah.
So I came to you and I was like, I don't know how to do Instagram and I'm confused about what works the best. And I hear content, but I don't know exactly what that means. And I also want it to feel authentic to who we are. And what did you tell me?
Yeah. So I think with every client and with you, we really kind of worked backward from the audience that we're trying to reach, the customer base that we're trying to reach, and your core business goals. So really those two questions that you have to answer, and usually sometimes we help the client answer that question, but a lot of times they have an idea of what they want that to be.
I love that on one page of one of your decks, you said, who's your target demographic? And then you flip it and it's like, you better not say everyone.
That's like one of my biggest things. Like we really, anyone can benefit from our service or our product. It's like, I want like a red button to press. Like, that's not going to work.
It's very hard though. I mean, it's defining that target demographic. Like in our case, you know, it's young professionals, but it's also new parents, and it's definitely both men and women. And yeah, people, you know, it's not just 28 to 45, although my guess is that that's it. And people who want convenience, but they also like to eat. Well, you know, is that a demographic? I don't know.
Well, that's many demographics. Right. And I think the important thing is to understand the different kind of pockets of demos that you're trying to reach, and know that to reach each demo, you're going to have to communicate with them differently. So, you know, we've spoken a lot about like, what does Haven's Kitchen Sauces look like for the single dad versus the young millennial who's like taking someone out or inviting them over on a date to do some home cooking with them. The actual product is different for each of them. And so the communication needs to be different. And so you can do a lot of that through social media.
Do you like that? I remember I have a friend who's an architect, and they were building a model of a new development, and it was actually really fun because she had to think of six different tenants in the building. Like Joe is in his mid 50s and he likes to listen to classical music and, you know, buys modern art, or like Sally and Jess or, you know, and she had these actual sort of prototypes of people. Mm-hmm. And then they did little mock-up apartments for each one.
Awesome.
It was so cool. Should we be thinking about our demographics that way? Like, should we have Joe and Sally and, you know, Ronaldo or whatever?
I think if that's helpful for you to kind of identify the ways they're spending time, how they're interacting with products and brands, I think absolutely that's a cool way to do it, to actually, you know, draw little stick figures and write out, like, do they spend time on Instagram or LinkedIn?
What does she do on the weekends?
Like, what's her grocery budget? Can she afford this? Or is this a splurge item? Or
how many of those do you think it would be reasonable for me to have?
I think for newer businesses, it's very tempting to do a lot of things at the same time. I think it's harder to do fewer things really well. So I would say like 2 to 3. I always think if you can develop a rabid audience within a smaller segment of people, within a smaller demo, you are on the right path much more than being kind of mediocre with a couple different demos.
Yeah, that seems to be the lesson. This depth versus width theme seems to be occurring.
And coming from all of my experience at HuffPost has been at a place where it's all about width and scale. I remember when I started there, I think we had like 50 something different verticals, so different sections. And it was actually a big part of one of my initiatives there to like drill that down to like, I think when I left, maybe it was like 10 to 15.
Right. I remember the divorce one.
Yeah. And
there was a really good piece on that.
Yeah.
That I still send to people.
The divorce section is great.
Yeah.
It's really awesome. I remember though, at one point, like we had weddings and divorce, and like at some point it got merged into one, which was very, very odd.
What's it called? Weddings and divorce?
We changed it to relationships. And I actually think that's what it is today still. Because a lot of people, well, this is a tangential.
No,
but
I
like,
love tangents.
People who are married are, you know, it's intriguing to read about divorce. Like, not that you're going to or you want to get divorced. It's just kind of like, this is the other half.
Yeah.
And it really is half, you know? So it's the other side of the coin. So it wasn't one or the other in terms of our readers. So that's why we combined it.
So going back to,
you
know, sort of, you know, audience first. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, even just that deciding who that audience is and being really selective and specific. So let's work backwards. So let's say I choose three audiences.
Yep.
And I want to craft my social media sort of plan for each one of those three. So take one. And what do I do then?
I think, first of all, figure out where they're spending time.
Okay.
And digitally, and who they're interacting
right.
with.
So I keep saying, like, where do they go on the weekends? And you're talking about, and I mean, are they on LinkedIn?
I think where they go on the weekends, that question could be like, and what are, like, what brands are they wearing when they're doing that? Are they into adventure, or are they kind of into like the self-care, like, you know, book and spa kind of thing? It is where they're going on the weekends really does, it does impact who you're trying to speak to. But I think in terms of actually getting tactical about figuring out what your strategy is, I think often figuring out the platform where they're spending time and then actually just going out and looking at profiles and seeing, like, really seeing the Sally and the Joe and and what they're
doing. What are the options of profiles? I mean, what, where could they be spending their, or do people, and I think this might be a very dumb question, sorry.
I'm sure
Do people spend their time perusing LinkedIn the way that I spend my time perusing Insta?
I think on LinkedIn, there's more of a an intent by the from the people who are on it. So if you are a staffing agency, it is imperative that you have a presence on LinkedIn.
Or if you're looking for a job.
Or if you're looking for a job. But from like a brand perspective of what brand
would
have a strategy on LinkedIn.
So where could people be spending their time digitally?
A lot of Snapchat if they're younger, potentially.
Right.
Instagram, Facebook, you know, moms, older millennial moms are huge on Facebook. LinkedIn, like I mentioned, some of them, perhaps like email is a huge play with a specific demo.
Right.
It really is endless. Reddit, if you're like going after, you know, millennial men who are really into like show fandoms, or Twitch is younger guys who are into video game. You know, there's a lot of different WhatsApp if you want, if you want an international audience.
Right.
Yeah.
That's so fascinating.
Yeah.
I don't know what those things are. I don't think there are target demographics.
Probably not.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, except for the show. What were the...
Reddit? No.
Yeah. What'd you say? What's
Reddit, like, that's kind of hardcore nerd
show
entertainment
fandom.
Culture
that's
fandom.
What, right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But a lot of... I mean, Reddit has everything. But it's the hardcore fandoms that really do well there.
Interesting. That's okay. So now that I've figured out who my target is, because I mean, really the questions are, my questions, which we'll get to after the break, are sort of about the actual content itself.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's a step even way before that, which is figuring out, you know, you can make beautiful things and wonderful things and send them into like the interwebosphere and no one sees them, or they don't hit what you want them to hit, or they don't do what you want them to do. And that's a lot of money to spend.
Totally.
So
yeah.
I'm trying to back it up and sort of get, you know, do what I should have done earlier, which is really sort of hone in on who the people are that I'm trying to reach and then where they live on which platform. And then what?
So there's a very scary stat that, like, for Instagram, for example, which is kind of where you're putting a lot of your marketing efforts, about 70% of posts on Instagram don't get seen. So that's because...
At all.
or a very, very small number of views on those posts. And that's because I'm sure everyone has heard about this Instagram, this dark and twisty Instagram algorithm.
Yeah.
Where it's very much based on personalization. Instagram shows people who they think would be likely to engage with something post, but not necessarily all of your followers. So
I mean, out of 22,000 followers, when I post, so, and I've told you this, and it boggles my mind, and I've stopped caring because you've told me to stop caring, but there are some things that I post that get 1,000 likes, and there's some things that I post that get 60.
And that's your market research right there. That's great testing, because two things are probably not all, like, they're not the same thing. There's something to learn about each scenario. So sometimes you've asked a question, or sometimes
the quotes do really well.
They do well. And so people kind of, it's great to know that people are engaging with you on that level. They really are looking to you for inspiration or something like that.
That's right.
So when we first start working with clients, we always kind of just do a deep dive into, like, an audit, like, to really see what's working and what's not.
Right.
Your audience tells you, gives you so much information about what you should be doing. It's just tapping into it.
But that's my question. Is the audience telling me what's working, or is the algorithm not showing people something because it doesn't think it's going
to
work?
So it will always show it to some people. And based on how those people react to it, it will decide to show it to more people or less people.
Right.
So in the end, good content, I won't say always, because there is a lot of dark magic that goes into it, but good content wins. So if you put something out that's engaging and valuable or entertaining or teaches someone something new and they engage with it, Instagram will recognize that it's something that other people would be engaged with.
I do feel like lately I've seen a lot of cats either lunging at things or being pet in a slightly sort of sensuous way.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I don't know if that's my Instagram, like, telling me what
I think that's, like, revealing more about
honestly, I'm not, like, a cat person. I don't follow cats. I'm not hashtag cat anything. I'm not.
Uh-huh.
But I feel like somewhere someone got the memo that, like, animals making noise and, you know, getting pet with, like, a finger, you know,
it's a cheap trick on Instagram. Yes. Like, it was my dog's birthday the other day, and so I posted a photo of him, and of course it's, like, a super high performing post. Well, like, awesome. Like, great. Good for you, doggy.
Well, I mean, you know how I feel about, we had a panel a couple weeks ago, and I spent a good amount of time talking about my dog. And then there was this great New Yorker cartoon where someone's taking a picture of the dog, and the dog says, like, I feel really cheap when you use me to post on Instagram, like, to boost yourself in the algorithm.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to take a little break, and then we're going to come back and talk about, once we've established these targets, how to get them to engage with your brand and hear your story.
Today's program was brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. What do you think of when you hear Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh and squeaky cheese curds. Or deep fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Uplands Cheese, the Farmstead Cheese Company behind Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I think of delicious stinky Limburger and its long storied history. I think of Dunbarton Blue, made by master cheesemaker Chris Raleigh. I think of Ross Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Championship Cheese, and Satori's Black Pepper Bellavitano, the 2017 U.S. Championship Cheese. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, with lush grasslands and a glacial water supply that produce the very best milk. Fourth-generation cheesemakers combine old-world tradition with new ideas and the highest standards to make innovative cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
Hi, I'm back with Kiki Von Glinow, founder of Toast Media Group. We've talked a lot so far about the algorithm and cats, amongst other things. But I do want to get into, you know, if you're a small brand and, you know, you can't afford either a consultant, or you can't certainly afford to hire someone to do your social media, it's sort of the necessary evil of someone's job.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it's
your evil.
It's my evil. And, you know, it's funny because I really enjoy it. Mm-hmm. I love actually being able to give cooking tips to, you know, people who are like, how long should I roast my carrots for? And I love when people feel like something I've said made their day better, or, you know, I don't want to give it up. So, but I do feel like it takes a lot of time to come up with thoughtful things to say and pictures that are appealing and also tell the story of our brand.
Yeah.
So I guess my first question is if there are any ways that you can think of for someone who's kind of trying to figure it out on their own, a small emerging brand that has some following, you know, what are some ways that we can make it a little bit less taxing
sure.
on ourselves?
Well, I think one important thing that you mentioned is just that you enjoy it. Mm-hmm. That more than you will know comes across to the audience that right. you actually enjoy doing it. So I think one tip would be if your brand does a certain thing and just talking about only that thing is not enjoyable to you or it's taxing in some way, figure out how to find a lens into your brand in a way that you actually enjoyable. Enjoy it.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. I think the other thing is that in order to kind of take things to the next level without having a huge social media team behind you,
right.
really thinking about the content that your community is creating. So you mentioned this is general, like we're speaking right now about a brand that has somewhat of a following. Mm-hmm. So really being able to tap into the loyalists within that following and ask them to show you how they use your product or right. your service or something, and leveraging the content that they're creating within your own brand. I think people really underestimate how creative just the general
right,
public is now.
Right.
So, and they often are so flattered and love yeah. to be included in a brand story. So I think that's a really powerful thing to do.
That's great.
And then I think partnerships are something that people really don't take advantage of enough. They do take some work to develop, but there are so many young brands who are trying to find a voice for themselves on Instagram, who are mission aligned to other young brands struggling right. to find their voice. So kind of collaborating. I always, and this is something that Ariana taught me from HuffPost, she really never believed in competitors, but only collaborators, which I have kind of taken and used in every aspect of my business.
It's such a nice way to live too. I feel the same way.
Oh my God, yeah.
Because there's, you know, my friend Christine said this a long time ago, like there are enough cookies for everyone.
There totally are. There know? Are hundreds and of hundreds gazillions. Of millions users yeah. on Instagram.
I mean,
like, if all of them wanted sauce, you'd have a problem.
Right.
So that would be that would be tough to fulfill. So yeah, I think finding other people or individuals who share similar values or mission to you and talking to them, like, what could we do together? What could be a cool way to share audiences and or leverage each other for content.
Right.
There's a lot of opportunity there.
And then what, you know, I'm assuming you're going to say day one, but how early should an emerging brand with a product try to think about its strategy? Like it's digital. And I'm speaking mostly to yeah. Instagram because it's what I know. My guess mm-hmm. is that there are certainly some brands out there that are going to be kicking it on Facebook.
Right.
I don't know how Snap works that way, but yeah. for sure, let's, you know, we can throw in Facebook if you want to, but specifically for Instagram, when should we be thinking about that strategy and the content we're making? And
I think the biggest thing to think about when starting a strategy is who you're trying to reach. And for me, any business should have that question answered before
right.
they even launch. I'm almost also speaking about that from the perspective of someone who's building a separate business too, who talking to those people who you're trying to reach, finding them in real life, going standing in the park and just going up right. to them and asking them questions, things like that. I think that really starts to dictate what your strategy is before you actually sit down and say like, what am I going to post or how,
right.
you know, that's the hard part. It really is. Yeah.
It's really, the who.
Totally.
It's funny because a couple weeks ago, someone was saying you can't have a company without the why, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And now I feel like you can't have a company without the who either,
totally.
You know, like it's really those simple questions.
Yeah. I think we've seen so many copycat companies recently, and it's not always that like someone has found a way to do something insanely better, but they found a way to connect with an audience that another company hasn't connected with.
Right.
So again, like there can be multiple competitors, collaborators,
right,
in the same space. So to me, the why is obviously important, but the who is really the ultimate.
And in terms of, you know, selling a product versus creating a vibe, mm-hmm, of your product, right? I feel like a Glossier can do both.
Yeah.
You know, I'm mesmerized by like the lip gloss kind of coming out of the tube and like glossy and then like someone's lips, yeah, like it works. I want the lip gloss, mm-hmm, and I know what they're going for.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that that works as well with a company like mine that has a lot of different things going on, mm-hmm, because I have the school, I have the cafe, I have events, you know, there's and the sauces, mm-hmm, and then there's just sort of like the vibe of the brand, you know, so I don't know.
I think it's about distilling what Glossier really does well, and they were one of the first, I think, to really do this well. And it again comes down to people. I'm a broken record with like being audience first, customer first, like who that demo is that you're trying to reach, but then also having a face forward, a face forward ethos of your brand. So Glossier,
what does that mean? Yeah.
Was one of the first brands to really, take influencer marketing to the next level. That's what really built their company. Their company was built on Instagram, basically.
Right.
So they have that vibe, but the reason why people are really connecting with them is because everyone knows their social media editor Eva, who is constantly showing herself and her friends on the Instagram.
Right.
They know the founder Emily Weiss's assistant Morgan, like they do like the weekly or daily Morgan thing,
right?
So it's really they're not cool girls, they're not like inaccessible, they're relatable women who run this company that the community feels like they want to be a part of. So I think it's a vibe for sure, but it's a people vibe,
right,
rather than like a pretty picture for the sake of pretty picture thing. And of course, right, they have like cool gooey lip gloss videos, yeah, or whatever, which aligns with that. But it really is the people forward approach to the brand, I think, that is what put them on the map.
So speaking of who else is doing it well, and let's dissect why a little bit.
Sure. So one example I think I've shared with you before in the food brand space is Siete Foods. Mm-hmm. They are a family brand that makes like tortilla chips and tortillas and stuff like that, mm-hmm, health, in the health space.
They're like the Better For You Goya kind,
yeah,
of, right?
Yeah. And they
the Better For You El Paso.
Sure, right. Yeah. they really take that, I think the actual name is Siete Family Foods, and mm-hmm, they take the family thing very seriously. So you can see them at their family gatherings, how they're actually incorporating the meal, not in like a salesy way into what they're doing, but like just like they love what they create.
Right.
They also really do influencer marketing well. So I found them through influencers on Instagram who were enjoying their products and really seem to love the brand and the family. They really talk about the family too when they're talking about the brand.
I love that. Right.
Not just, you know,
the chips.
Yeah, the chips. Even though the chips are good.
Right.
So who I else? Think that's like you, and I feel like I've talked to you about this a lot too, but you are such a valuable opportunity for Haven's Kitchen to be the face of it.
Right.
And someone who people connect with. You are a very charismatic, just cool person running her own business. flatter the podcast host, right?
I know, exactly. I'm like sitting here blushing.
No, but I mean, that really is, that's a huge opportunity. So as much as you're figuring out who your audience is, it's also about figuring out who is going to be the person behind this.
Right.
People want to see who's making the sauce.
Right, right. I mean, and it's funny because Katie has gotten much more comfortable in, mm-hmm, that role too,
yeah,
you know, because she's actually making the sauce,
right?
You know, and it's
and she's
like,
also such a cool person.
She's
that,
the
like,
coolest
the
person.
First time I met her, I'm like, I want to be best friends.
I know,
is that cool?
I know. It's like, and the two of us have this sort of funny dynamic, yeah, together because, you know, we kind of play off of each other in a, mm-hmm, way. So we're definitely trying to figure out how to do that in a way that But neither one of us is totally comfortable, A, on camera, or B, sort of like with anything other than totally authentic. Right. So it's a little
and that is key for that kind of face forward approach to your brand distribution on these channels is authenticity.
Right.
Again, people who love Instagram, they're on Instagram all day long, so they can sniff out a phony immediately. So if you're trying to be like,
well, I think that's what that, you know, we had a woman named Taryn Langer on a couple mm-hmm. weeks ago, and she was talking more about like the PR and sort of like not the digital stuff, but she was saying that the reason why traditional media is making such a comeback is because there's so much content out there and there's so many people's opinions about everything and there's so many sponsored things and mm-hmm. that actually hearing from an expert, this is good and this is what this company stands for and this is why I like it, is more meaningful now because we have so much being thrown at
right.
it. And I feel like that's the same in a way with social. I'm scrolling much faster now than I used to. I mean, I can
You're
feel
You're assuming
it.
It's all just like
a lot of it.
Brand
and
spewing.
I see pictures that look exactly like other pictures that I know where they got the inspiration from. And I'm also starting to see less polished stuff coming up because I feel like people are starting to want to see that stuff too.
Yeah.
Can you just speak a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. About, I think that's a big trend that's kind of coming or here in a bit. On Instagram is the pretty for the sake of pretty is not really working anymore. I mean, it's working to some extent, but I think the future of Instagram is going to be much more about like that raw authenticity. Someone who I think does this super well as a woman named Jen Gotch. She's the she's the founder and I think maybe the COO now or CCO something of Bando, that accessories company.
She's just very raw.
Very rough.
Super
she will have
duper raw.
Panic attacks on. Oh, that was my Chicago accent slipping out there. She will have full on panic attacks on Instagram stories. She takes photos of herself crying. She deals with mental illness challenges and has a podcast actually for Girl Boss around mental illness.
Right.
And she's just someone who I think the support she's gotten on Instagram and the people who are kind of saying, this is what I want to see. I want to see someone who's relatable to me, who's going through the same things as me, and I trust her now. So I think that is going to be kind of the new normal on Instagram. It might take a little while for the sake of pretty to go away.
Well,
but.
And it's interesting having, when you're trying to sell a product, have it not be gussied up is a little, it's challenging. You want to put your best foot forward. Yeah. You know, I do get a ton of really adorable, very loving DMs from people who use the sauce and their pictures. You know,
they're not photographers.
I wouldn't say that they're photographers and I wouldn't say that I'm like, oh, got to make that for dinner. Yeah. But I want to, you know, I want to not reward them, but I want to show them how much it really does. I get every one of those and I love it. And it makes me so happy that they feel like we've helped them make dinner.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't post those. Would you say that's like an area to put like for stories?
I would say, Instagram stories. So the feed.
Yeah.
Does
so
feel
let's break it down a little bit. Your first of all, your feed, how many post there was something like there was a couple months ago, like 3 posts a day or something. And I had a nervous breakdown because one is rough for me.
One is rough. And I think for a lot of smaller brands, one, if you can get to a consistent one a day, that's great. And it really is all about consistency.
In the sense that you want it to be at the same time every day?
No, I think you can kind of start to see when your users are engaging with you most. So you get a lot of those insights and analytics when you sign up for a business account on Instagram. So I would suggest that everyone convert to a business account so they can have access to those analytics. But it tells you kind of when your followers are most engaged on Instagram. I think if you have the resources to do more than one, that's great. Instagram, when I was... I was the liaison for Instagram when I was at HuffPost, and when I spoke to them a lot about optimization, they said they kind of thought up to 7 a day was a good spot to be.
Wow.
And that kind of is a little bit more relevant today even because the algorithm has changed, I think it was maybe 2 or 3 months ago, to value recency a little bit more.
So, but if I were posting 7 a day, people would unfollow. I mean, I feel like people would just be offended.
Not the same people are seeing all those 7 posts. So if, you know, let's say 70% of your followers are not seeing every post.
Wow.
Then maybe a portion of that 70% is seeing the second one, and then another slice is seeing the third. So it really, I mean, the algorithm is, it really is dark magic. So it's not, I don't believe, and it's not an exact science. They haven't shared the algorithm with me by any means, but I don't think that Instagram would show someone something enough to make them unfollow. That's not their goal.
Right. Got it. Okay. So you have your feed, and the optimum amount is somewhere between 1 and 7
But if you're a small business, I would say one is great to get consistent. If you're already doing one, go up to the next level to do two. But what I would say in terms of ranking prioritization of these different atoms within this ecosystem that is Instagram is I think Instagram stories is probably the most important place for small brands to be sharing their message. That's where people are interacting most with
on
the platform. I think there's something like 250 million Instagram stories posted a day. So that's really where people are spending time. And then I would say feed probably comes after that. For stories, I suggest that people try to do at least 60 seconds a day. So that might be 4 15-second videos. That might be a couple slides of, you know, however you mix and match it.
Kind of what's going on.
Yeah.
And then live versus IGTV.
So they're very different. Okay. I think try to shoot for a live once a week. People are very afraid of Instagram Live because...
No, you know why? I can tell you why. I mean, because...
Real-time feedback or what?
No, because if no one's watching, because you see on the... Don't you see how many people are watching if you're watching?
The thing that I think is great about Live, I don't care if anyone's watching, but it gives me content that I can then share to stories so that people can interact with it there. So to me, it's double dipping. And hopefully once you start doing it more often, people will start watching. If it's the first time you've done it, maybe Instagram doesn't show it to that many people.
No, I had the first time I did a live, it was in the morning, and it was while all of the prep cooks were getting the muffins and the scones ready, and they were making the coffee and we were starting to get ready for the day. Yeah. And there were 150 people or something that were watching. And I thought it was so cool.
That's great.
And I was hi, you know. And then the next time I did it, I think it was 3. And so I just felt like that was a fluke.
But also learn what was the different about them. You know, was one, they like to see people in action and it was the time of day that really worked. And the other, or was it the same thing both times?
I tried to do the same thing because I was trying to do sort of an early mornings at Havens, you know, welcome to our cooking school. Yeah. But no, I don't know. And then it just makes you feel kind of like a dork. You know, that you're doing this live thing that no one's watching.
Think one of the hardest parts, and I also work with a lot of clients in the health and wellness space, and that's one of the biggest hurdles for them too, is to just put stuff out there and not have anything happen it And I think it's just kind of getting over it, knowing that sometimes when you film yourself, you'll look terrible. And sometimes when you do a live, no one will watch. Right. And
you
that's just
can't
that
have
is,
any.
Yeah,
ego
you
about
can't.
It.
Yeah.
Okay, so live is one time a week.
Yes.
And then IGTV is this new thing.
So IGTV is Instagram's stab at kind of taking down YouTube.
Right. Which is great for someone like me.
Yeah.
Because I like it all being in one place.
In one place, yeah. Which is, they have a big advantage there that people are spending a lot of time there. So it's a place where I think... you can record up to 10 minutes right now. They're going to up that to about an hour. I think only celebrities have the hour.
And do you have
right
to
now.
Click into it? Or is that the thing at the top in orange? Someone has a video on, you know.
And also when you visit someone's profile, it's right next to the Instagram stories highlights.
Got
that lives.
Right,
now.
right. Of course.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I think IGTV is a place where I think it was produced or it was a feature that was initially intended for higher touch, higher production video. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's not the case for everyone. I think of it as a place where if you have something to say that you don't want to press record every 15 seconds, and it's not imperative that you're live, you don't need that in real-time feedback or user participation, then
IGTV it's a good tutorial video.
Totally,
place.
Yes. If you were going to do a 10-minute recipe, I think that would be a great spot to do it.
And what about ads? I have...
bought ads. We did videos, mm-hmm. you know, little and yeah. like cooking videos beautiful with videos, our sauces. Yeah. Thank you. And I promoted them. Mm-hmm. Is that, that's an ad, right?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So I clicked promote and then it asked me all these questions yeah. and I was like, ah, I don't know, whatever. And then it said your budget and your radius and whatnot. I was like, whatever. So I kind of toyed around with the little slidey thing. I have yeah. no idea what I did. Is there a, what's the story? Should we be buying those? Should we
I
be?
I think it's a slippery slope. Okay. I generally, for most of my smaller business clients, I don't advocate for it unless you have pretty deep marketing budget pockets.
Okay.
I think most people know Facebook owns Instagram. The way Facebook paid marketing, kind of that trajectory went from a lot of small businesses spend money in the beginning, they see a decent return for it, and the more and more money they spend, the less they start getting for it. So it's
right.
kind of once Facebook views you as someone who's willing to spend money on the platform, your organic growth is going to be kind of cut at the knees a bit.
Interesting.
So I would say if you are kind of thinking, I'm really going to double down and do a sprint on trying to grow my Instagram or my Facebook or whatever it is, try to do that organically for a couple of months to see
right.
what organic growth you get.
It definitely hasn't grown. From my understanding, the promotions have not grown our Instagram following.
Yeah.
What I'm hoping is that people who don't follow me see the mm-hmm. ads and buy the sauce. But
right.
is that not going to happen?
That the conversion there is pretty low because they have to see your ad, go to your profile, and then try to like feel like they want to engage with you a step further.
Right.
I would say Instagram is powerful because of repetition. When someone is starting to see other people make their dinners with your sauces via
right.
Instagram stories, or they just see how you're using it over and over again, that
right.
kind of triggers their mind. I'm comfortable with this now. I think
right.
There is an opportunity to retarget people that you've targeted on these ad platforms, which I think is, if you are going to spend money, is a good way to do it, just to move them down the funnel.
So what does that mean?
So if you within this batch of paid promotion reached me, you have the opportunity next time you promote something to reach me again.
Oh, mm-hmm. How you do?
Yeah.
Right. You can say that?
Yeah, there, it's within the settings of the ad a bit.
Interesting. You're going to help me with that,
yeah.
right? After we do this. Okay.
Sure.
What are some mistakes you see brands making?
I think there are a few of them. I think we've touched on some of them. A lot of the pretty for the sake of pretty or trying to mm-hmm. to be like other brands on a platform because it's working for that other brand. It's working for that other brand because it's authentic to them or it makes sense for them.
Right.
What makes sense for another brand doesn't always make sense for you. So I think finding your individual take on something is really key. It's not easy, but I think that's where people get caught up with just trying to be like someone else.
Right.
And again, just not knowing who you're trying to reach or trying to reach everyone, that's not going to lead to really anyone in the end because no one feels an immense connection with you or your brand.
I think that's great. All right. For the last couple of minutes, I guess I wanted to ask you, I like this question, like if you were going to write a book about social media strategy or digital growth, you can either choose like a chapter or two or like the title or even just like the main thesis of the book.
Oh, man.
I know it's a hard one.
I think like maybe like the title would be something. This sounds so lame.
No, like, I'm sure it's not going to sound lame.
Like you do you. Just like do
right.
you.
Right.
Don't try to be someone else. Whatever you do, make it something you like. I think when there's passion behind any sort of story or messaging or what brand story, whatever it is,
yep.
it comes across.
People can feel it
yeah.
for sure.
So I think it would be about that and being real about what you can take on. I think so like that would be knowing what you're good at and what you need to delegate to other people too. I've
right.
seen a lot of people, and especially small brands, who just try to do everything themselves. Like you have a great team behind you, but
right.
Some people who don't, it's just prioritizing and figuring out what you do really well and then being passionate about that thing and doing it
awesome.
And getting it done.
And then the last question, what's the most fun you've had being, let's break it down into like your consulting work. Like what's been, when have you been like, I love today?
I had one client who has, she runs like a yoga school, yoga program, mm-hmm. and she has like these international retreats, mm-hmm. and she sold out one of her retreats based on our Instagram campaign, which is like her revenue for the year.
That's so amazing.
Like, that was really, I love it when clients just like have major success stories and then email me like with a lot of exclamations being like, holy shit.
Yeah. No, that's amazing.
Yeah.
All right, Kiki, thank you so much. Thank you for your help with me. Thank you for helping all of the listeners. And if you want to follow Kiki on Instagram, it's at KikiVonGlinow.
I'm impressed.
Yeah, because it's such a great name. We didn't even get into like how you got that name. But at first, I didn't think it was real, but it's real. And David, I just want to thank you for being the engineer of engineers. This may be the last one of this season. So it's been really fun getting to talk about Haven's Kitchen and other emerging brands, and peeking through the window and seeing David laugh every once in a while has been sort of the highlight of that. So I don't know when the next In the Sauce is going to be, but there will be a next time. So I will see you then.
Thanks, Allie.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.